Hello, everybody. Welcome to Free Kiwis. Today, we're joined by Jonathan Ayling from the Free Speech Union. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hey, Michael. It's great to be with you guys again.
We'd like to talk to you today about the university's ranking report that's recently come out of the Free Speech Union, based, I think, on a survey run earlier in the year, as well as qualitative information from the universities. Is that right?
That's correct. And maybe I'll just take a bit of a step back as we introduce this to start with and go, you know, a lot of the work that we do, it's related to the politics around free speech. And I think in public imagination, free speech is part of the culture war. And from my perspective, from the work that we do, I'm not sure that's always very helpful. I would say free speech goes across political divides and kind of bridges a lot of these cultural conversations, but it goes beyond politics, it goes beyond politicians, and I see it actually most opposed in the university. And so that's why we at the Free Speech Union have been getting involved with this, where many people look at the hate speech laws or regulation of social media or something like that as the key front for free speech. At the Free Speech Union, we're looking at the way the culture is being framed by the universities and the opposition to free speech that is emerging from there. So that's why we've committed to a body of work that will be consistently updated and annually to assess both free speech and academic freedom. And you're both academics. You know well the difference between those two, that it's a bit of a technicality sometimes, but there are meaningful differences as well. And so we want to look at both free speech and academic freedom on university campuses here in New Zealand and assess the way that those universities are living up to their statutory responsibility. So that, you know, universities are required to uphold these values. Unfortunately, in practice, we see that it's certainly not the case. And even in word, they often kind of say one thing and say the other in the same moment. So that's why we are investing in this space and want to continue to raise this conversation at the source of what we see as the opposition to free speech.
Wonderful. And we will get into, you know, what the differences might be between free speech and academic freedom a little bit later. I think it's worth actually just picking up on a point you made there about free speech not being a kind of politically partisan idea and perhaps a mistaken idea that it's part of a culture war. Although I wonder sometimes whether it's part of the culture war if one side in the culture war is seeking to attack it more than another. So I think about free speech as a framework within which you can have a liberal democracy and in fact an open society. There may be people who have values outside of liberal democracy and open society, in other words, who don't necessarily want a liberal democracy or an open society, who will therefore attack free speech. And then perhaps it would be part of a culture war legitimately that we need to fight back against in order to preserve the conditions within which we can contest ideas politically and scientifically and so on.
Absolutely. Of course, there obviously are ardent opponents of this notion of free speech. So some of the people that I have to deal with who consider free speech to be a patriarchal, colonialistic, oppressive way of structuring a society that only elevates certain voices, I think those arguments are very quickly undressed. But obviously there are those that come from a value structure that is beyond a democratic idea. My comment, I'm simply saying that within that left-right spectrum, yes, which we see politics on, it's simply an accurate to claim one side or the other is the champion or the opponent of free speech. Both have used and both have abused free speech at different periods of time. Curiously, because in our current cultural milieu, we might claim that if anything, free speech is a center-right notion. From my opinion, actually, I think the right has tended to undermine and oppress speech more frequently than the left. And it's just at this time of day that we are at with our culture that it seems that there are certain operatives that tend to come from the progressive left that maybe are less inclined towards free speech now. But no, all that to say, it comes down to whether you value liberty and basic individual freedoms versus an authoritarian perspective. I think that is a divide that you can make to decide whether parties will be pro-free speech or opposed to free speech.
Yes. I mean, certainly you only have to go back to the 1960s to see a time at which, you know, what you might call the left was very much the champion of free speech and, in fact, on behalf of oppressed minorities, far from it being something that elevates the voices of the privileged. It's actually been the vehicle by which, you know, privilege and authority has been challenged. But, you know, let's move on now to the rankings. So tell us a bit about that. How did you go about constructing these rankings before we go into the details of which universities did best in them?
Well, the rankings report is a piece of work that has come out of a survey that was done earlier in the year. We engaged Courier Market Research, so a very prominent polling firm, to assess the perception of academic freedom held by lecturers at their own universities, or academics more generally in their own institutions. So, you know, a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland was commenting on the state of academic freedom within the University of Auckland, and a professor at Otago Universities were commenting at Otago. And so what this has let us do is take the temperature of the room, really, of these academics within their own contexts and saying, how do you perceive it? So it's not totally objective. It is, it is subjective by definition, but I think it's an important way of assessing how these people feel they can operate with regards to academic freedom again. And so that report was really interesting, and we put it out to some journalists, and they came back to me and said, well, sorry, what's the story here? And the fact that almost just as many academics in our country within their institutions felt more constrained than free, I think that's quite a story. I think if we hold the university to be an institution where knowledge can be advanced and assumptions and dogmas challenged, the fact that many academics feel unable to do different features of that is very problematic. I think there's a big story there. Now, we will be the first to admit that the survey that we released earlier this year raises more questions than answers. We're not claiming that it provides solutions to any of this, but I think it raises important questions going, why do so many academics, and you know, we put it out to 17,000 academics in this country. We had a significant, you know, without a doubt, a statistically significant number of responses to make these polling really accurate. Why do they feel so constrained? And we constructed the questions that they answered off the Education and Training Act and the way that the requirements that universities are supposed to operate under are structured there. And simple things like raising controversial perspectives with your colleagues. Many academics felt very constrained on a scale of 1 to 10. And so I ask, how can we start to address any one of the many complex issues that we're trying to deal with today and that face our society if we are no longer able to raise alternative perspectives in the very institution that only operates because of the notion of academic freedom?
So in that survey, as I recall, there were some issues where academics did feel relatively free to voice opinions on perhaps controversial topics within those domains, and others where they really didn't.
That's right, yes. Yeah. And so there were some really positive elements as well. You know, something like the freedom to criticize the government, a crucial liberty within a democratic society. They felt quite enabled, and that's brilliant. And there were those that noted that freedom, and there were also others that said on things like the ability to teach you the material that you want. They came back and said, well, I actually don't operate as an island in the sea. I'm part of a faculty. We assess this together. So I rate this relatively lowly, but I don't think we should have the freedom to just operate independently in that regard.
Well, we're constrained by disciplines as academics.
Absolutely. I think that's a very legitimate response. So certainly not all the responses were troubling, but when half felt considerably more constrained and free to discuss issues relating to the Treaty of Waitangi, when 47% felt considerably constrained versus free to discuss issues relating to sexuality and gender, some of these major questions that we're trying to assess, we are going to run into problems. We are already running into problems that are the fruit of this hesitance. And I think self-censorship beyond regulation, beyond government legislation, beyond any violent force that constrains speech, self-censorship is the greatest threat that we have to liberal democracy and to free expression, free thought, and academic freedom. And so the fact that this polling shows that these academics feel very constrained and ergo self-censor within that I think it should be a wake-up call for many of us who appreciate these liberties.
Yes, and I think you're right. I think we can already see the results of this problem in political discourse in this country, and certainly in other countries. I mean, America is notoriously polarized, but even New Zealand now seems to be rapidly headed that way, along some of the lines that you've mentioned in terms of especially issues to do with the Treaty of Waitangi.
Well, and I want to pick up on that because, and I'll illustrate it with an event that we held last night at Otago University. We are in an increasingly polarized age, but I don't believe that's because we're considering particularly exceedingly more complex issues or exceedingly more divisive issues than we have in the past. We're constantly having to deal with complex, difficult questions about how we will structure our society. I believe we exist in an increasingly polarized age because we have let go of this very fundamental tool of being able to engage with each other in dialogue and in conversation and assess and attack and hurt and violently oppose ideas.
When you say violently, of course, you mean with verbal exactly. toughness. Yeah,
that's right. You know, we always come against this, well, words can harm. And I say, good, words must harm. Worms must tear down. Words must destroy ideas.
Because it's better than weapons doing so, right?
That's exactly right. And that is the only alternative. Do not accept from anyone else that there is another option. We either let words have their way or weapons will. And I think we see history explain that time and time again, where words are suppressed, violence inevitably follows. But I think what I'm trying to illustrate there is this polarization comes from the fact that we are no longer able to engage in conversation and dialogue. And this event that we hosted at Otago University last night, we had a panel discussion on politics and responsible free speech. And, you know, the lecture theatre was packed. So there was standing room only. It was overflow. We had about 200 people showing up there. And we had three gentlemen, white men from the right, contribute on the panel and no one else. And I called it out from the very start. You know, there were journalists and media there. And I said, you may look at this and consider us a very biased organization to only platform these voices, whereas that is not the case at all. We reached out to each of the four members of parliament from the Labour Party that are based in Dunedin. We reached out to the Greens caucus. We reached out to the Otago Students Union Association. We reached out to a number of student voice groups, and none of them would come and speak on the subject of politics and responsible free speech. And I cannot fathom what is threatening or oppressive or undermining or dangerous or any of these other words that they lodge against free speech about the notion of free speech and responsible politics. And so, you know, our debate was impoverished by their absence. We did not have the same debate that we could have had that frankly we need on this subject without them there to put forward their ideas. But I cannot help but believe that they were the ones that are the most impoverished by the fear that they obviously have to be seen with the wrong people, to engage with the wrong ideas, to simply be exposed to ideas that they don't hold themselves, you know. And so that's where I think this polarization is coming from more than anything. I think we need to cling to that tool that has proved so valuable over centuries to actually work our way through these questions, and that is dialogue.
Yes, I mean, it seems that for the moment we've seen off the hate speech legislation, and that's a good thing. But when you have this cultural reticence to engage in open dialogue with people with whom you disagree, that's the harder battle to win, because of course that's not a legal matter, it's a cultural one, and you know, how we address that is a big question. But I'd like to move now to the rankings report. Now, that's based to some extent on that earlier survey, but it's brought in other factors as well. Is that right? Can you explain a bit how your ranking system has worked?
That is correct. So there are 8 universities in New Zealand, and we have assessed each one of them, taking both qualitative and quantitative perspectives. Now, with the survey results that we have, the hard data of the academics based within the institutions themselves, and then also looking at the policies that the universities have governing things like codes of conduct, social media guidelines, student conduct statutes, etc. So you've got the qualitative, the quantitative, and then you've got the practice as well. In reality, how have these universities responded to controversial speech or provocative protests, etc. And so you see that in a similar way to the survey illustrated, there is a breadth here. There are both some positive things that are happening and unfortunately some quite negative and what I would consider quite pernicious activities as well. And so Victoria University, which I don't know if I've ever been prouder to be an alumni or alumnus rather of Victoria, or maybe are we supposed to say the University of Wellington now? I know that was Grant Goodford's drum to bang.
No, in legislation, it's still Victoria it University is, of Wellington. Is. So
yes. You know, both in terms of the survey responses and the policies that they have in place and the examples that we have of tolerance, true tolerance, where we allow diversity of opinions and speech, Victoria continues to lead the country, I would say, in what it means to operate with respect to those differences. And that's not to say there's not room for improvement there as well. And Professor Nick Smith is going to be the Vice Chancellor there shortly, replacing Grant Guildford. And so I hope that he will pick up this mantle and maintain a legacy that is tolerant in that regard.
Well, he has a title to defend now, doesn't he? So
yes, yes.
I was a bit disturbed, to be honest, that when we put up posters for the Free Speech Union event at Vic around the Kelburn campus, or I did, I suppose, that a lot of them were taken down and these were replaced by posters basically calling the Free Speech Union various bad names. So I didn't like that. I don't really think that's the way that students should be engaging with ideas. Rather than say, you know, just coming along to the event and asking respectful but robust questions. I mean, I would encourage people to do that, and, you know, the next time they have a chance. But I will say that, I mean, what you were looking at really is the institutional response, right? And
that's exactly
right. Vic did hold firm on that, so they should be congratulated for that.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So from a cultural perspective, there's an enormous amount of work to be done in terms of the way particularly younger New Zealanders see the right to raise quote-unquote harmful ideas, this very subjective notion where insert whatever you personally believe is harmful and you have harmful speech. But I think that is something that is quite distinct from the way the university itself has conducted itself. And that was what this report was trying to assess.
So Victoria did very well, came top of the rankings. Mm. Which universities didn't do so well? I mean, it's there for all to see, so we might as well talk about it, right?
Well, if you know anything about the state of play within tertiary education in New Zealand, you might assume that Massey University would be the bottom of the list. And to the credit of a university that in the past has deserved very little credit around free speech, I think there has been some improvement there. And the Free Speech Union is in the process of engaging with the university right now around a new policy about free speech. We haven't seen that material released publicly yet. And so hopefully it will set a new standard. But Massey University did allow the Free Speech Union to come and speak earlier this year with Don Brash.
Who started all of this. His event, his banning from Massey by Vice Chancellor Jan Thomas.
That's correct.
In many ways started the whole furor in New Zealand about free speech. And
rightly so, I would say, where these spurious accusations around protests and potential violence and health and safety, et cetera, are really just being used to quash ideas that people disagree with. And that's no way to go about debate. But Massey University has improved in that regard and hopefully will continue to do so. There are obviously still a number of concerning aspects about their conduct. And so they received a C+. I wanted to just note when Don Brash and I went on Massey campus up in Palmerston North to hold this lecture, where we had, again, hundreds of Free Speech Union supporters and students there as well. I was escorted on with Don Brash with more private security than I've seen in my life. And a few people will know, I grew up in Mozambique in a very rural part of the country. I lived in Kenya during attacks from Somalia, Al-Shabaab. I'm not unaware of private security, but I had never seen it like that before. And I thought, golly gosh, what are we stepping into here in Palmerston, North New Zealand? Are we going to have all these people attacking us or whatever? The university had flown private security up from Christchurch and down from Tauranga. And apparently a number of the private security were former guards of ambassadors in Iraq and Afghanistan. What a waste of money and time that was. There wasn't a single protester. There was no one who wasn't polite. You know, there was disagreements, but they engaged with the material. And I actually think it's that sort of response and that sort of approach to controversy that continues polarization. It actually perpetrates people running into their corners. And I thought there wasn't the security guard's fault, obviously, but the university's perspective there was harmful itself. And I think they by viewing our speech as so provocative and so unseemly that we had to be defended from violence, which was demonstrably not the case, I actually thought they were their own worst enemies. And I made sure that the administration was aware of our perspective on that. But no, sorry, waffling on there a little bit, Michael, to your question, Auckland University of Technology is the only university on the ranking to have received an F grade and is without a doubt at the moment the institution in New Zealand that is most opposed to the freedom of expression.
Yeah, can I pick that point up? Because it was interesting. I was reading through this and there's a nice summary at the beginning of the report, the rankings report, where you just sort of gave all the rankings for the universities and a brief summary of why they got those grades. And I just thought, wow, AUT did really badly in this course because it got an F. And I don't know what grade scale you're using, but at Vic, we don't even have an F. We just have a D and E. So, and then you look at the next worst performers tied for the sort of next worst are Massey and Waikato, and they're tied on a C. So what explains the terrible grade that AUT got? Why was it so much worse than even Massey?
There's a number of issues at play there, but I would summarize it as these other institutions at least give lip service to free speech and have on one or two occasions been seen to stand with their perspective. AUT doesn't even appear to, it appears to be indifferent about being known to be opposed to free speech, and its treatment of numerous organizations, one of which is the Free Speech Union, but I don't think that is the really the most material fact there. There are a number of organizations, including their own student magazine, that have been constantly opposed for the speech that they are sharing. And within the administration, I have, in my role as the chief executive of the Free Speech Union, I've never had university administration treat our organization with such disdain and disregard. So we are actually in the process of legal action against AUT. I think probably that is worth noting in terms of where this university has fallen in the ranking. But their insistence on controlling the narrative, controlling the speech of those who are present on the campus there, I think means that they could only be given this grade.
And the legal action is to do with the banning of a Free Speech Union event on the campus a few months ago, is that right?
That is correct, and it was demonstrably only because we were platforming an individual that they deemed dangerous because of her ideas.
And which were gender critical feminism was that?
That's exactly right. So Daphne Whitmore was set to join us at a union meeting at AUT, and at first we had welcomed the public to join this union meeting as well. The university had been very pleased to welcome us and to have us there at first. It was a few days after our advertising had gone live with who we were platforming and why she was there. It was to discuss the work that the Free Speech Union had been able to offer her as a member and why others should join. We know of one lecturer that became very animated in opposing our ability to stand there, our right to actually enter the campus. And it was on the basis of one lecturer's concerns that is related specifically to the rainbow tick status of the university, that the administration came up with one excuse after another for why we couldn't be there. And as I worked with them, they cancelled the event 2 days before we were supposed to hold the meeting when we had approached them first 2 months earlier. And they raised one excuse, which, you know, they said, you don't have the right paperwork. I made sure they had every piece of paper that they needed. And then they said, oh, well, you haven't done this correctly. And we worked through everything. And it was really just gaslighting. They were just trying to find whatever reason they could to stop us from expressing the perspectives that Daphne shares.
It's a really interesting point in itself that just the complaint of one person was enough to get a whole event shut down, because, you know, you also have to think, well, how many people would have turned up? And I mean, if, you know, if your event said Otago and Victoria or anything to go by, the answer is probably like, you know, maybe 50 to 200 people or something like that. So if there's that number of people who are interested in seeing an event and hearing somebody speak, why should that then be trumped by one person who doesn't want the event to go ahead? So it's kind of, you know, there's lots of basic liberalism involved in these points that we're making about free speech, but there's also sort of basic democratic points as well, which is, you know, maybe you have a view that's strongly held, but other people also have their views, and we have to kind of balance these in society. And it seems a bit strange that, you know, just this one very angry person gets to win out over sort of, in some cases, hundreds of other people's preferences.
Absolutely. And not that you're arguing against this at all, but even if it was one person that wanted to express that and no one showed up to the event, they should allow those arguments and that speech to still be presented. But exactly what you're saying is obviously correct, that there were many people interested in this. Why should one person's concern around that trumpet? And it comes down to the fact that the ideas that were being shared allegedly are harmful, oppressive, and indisputably not on vogue. And we see that bad things happen to societies when we dictate what speech is and is not allowed, but because of conventionality. And I really want to challenge those who are our would-be censors. Where do you think this ends? What do you think emerges from suppression and censorship of this kind? Because time and time again, history shows us that it results in violence. It results in the voices of minorities primarily being squashed, because you mentioned at the beginning, Michael, that free speech actually elevates the one with the least power. Jonathan Rauch, the famous American journalist who was very involved in the gay marriage debate over there, famously said, "Free speech is not minorities' greatest friend. It is minorities' only friend." Mm-hmm. And I think it is a real perversion of the great tool and the foundation on which a stable and peaceful society can be built, that free speech has been distorted in this way to supposedly undermine minorities. In reality, free speech is the one that protects their voices. Allegedly, as white men, we have privilege and we have power, and certainly within our society, I think there's something to be said for that. We don't need free speech. We get to just speak. And because we have that privilege, the speech will be allowed, whereas it is the speech of the unprivileged. And perhaps our society is changing to an extent that those that formerly were privileged are not anymore, but it is the speech of the unprivileged, the unpowerful, the victimized and the vulnerable that is protected by free speech.
Yes,
and
so I suspect it's actually more viewpoint lines along which the power runs now, rather than sex or ethnicity or I mean, it's undoubtedly true that education will always be a marker of privilege, because that's what gives you the power to make points in a refined and articulate way and to convince people with your speech and so on. So I think we have to be cognizant of that and be aware.
I think that's a very good point.
Be aware of the deep socioeconomic inequality that is correlated with educational inequality. Mm. So that we have to be aware that there are people who, even though they might technically be allowed to say what they want, they don't have either the platform or the means of articulating themselves.
And perhaps if I can take this in a slightly more controversial space then to illustrate that point, and from the outset, I shouldn't feel like the need to do this, but I do. I am boosted and triple vaxxed and not in any way opposed to vaccination. But for those that joined in the protest at Parliament,
yes,
I think the condescension that we saw against exactly what you're saying there, Michael, those that as a large part, now there was a variety of different types of people there, but for a large part it was working class people that for the most part do not have institutional voices or platforms to express themselves, are not for the most part against speaking in very broad strokes, those of a very you know, who had received a high degree of education. And so you saw this condescension emerge where, well, sometimes their messaging was a little bit convoluted, or they weren't able to articulate their concerns very well. And I say, fair enough. And look, our speech should be clear. We should seek to communicate as responsibly as possible. But it seemed like a very elitist way of viewing these people that were, as best as they could, expressing themselves and using their free speech. And as you're saying there, Michael, education is an elevator in every society. And perhaps they were part of this disadvantaged minority today whose speech has been oppressed.
Still, you could also be a highly educated person who happens to be white and male, and you can have held high offices in the state, and you can still be shut down. I mean, that was the case of Don Brash, for example.
But that's true. Yeah.
Anyway, I actually just wanted to go back to the survey, and then we'll move on to something else. Another question I wanted to ask you is about various types of threats at the university, because reading through your survey, I noticed that it's not all the threats are coming from one side. I mean, I think most of the threats are coming from the so-called woke left, the extreme progressives at universities. And a lot of the examples that you gave in your rankings report seem to come from that quarter. However, there were also a few other things going on. So one of them was the threat from China, the Communist Party of China. It sounds kind of almost conspiratorial to think that they can have an effect on New Zealand universities, but it does seem as if some of the New Zealand universities have been a little bit, gone along a bit too far with pressures from that quarter. And then the other thing I noticed, I think maybe there was just one case of this, but a threat to free speech from a quarter that I remember quite well from the 90s was more of a threat to free speech, which is the conservative religious right. One lecturer in particular who I think he was threatened with being disciplined for referring to religious people as cranks, and you defended
That's
him.
Right.
So I just wanted to get a sense from you, like what is your sense as an organization of the gravity of these three threats, I suppose, the progressive left, the Christian right, and the Chinese Communist Party, and are there any others out there as well that we should be aware of?
Yeah, those are brilliant questions there. I'll deal with the last one first. Just to be clear, the lecturer at Waikato University who referred to creationists and religious individuals as cranks was not censored by any religious institution or actually by any religious students within his classes. It was from the university itself.
All right.
Okay. And you certainly can't consider the University of Waikato or I think Nigel Quigley, I think, is the vice chancellor there.
Neil Quigley,
is it? Yeah. As an individual who is associated with that community. Also, I just don't want to cast spurious allegations on that perspective.
That's a good correction. Thank you for that.
But with regards to the other examples, I think really important to note that, and unsurprisingly, AUT, yet again, was one of the institutions that kowtowed to the Chinese consulate when an event commemorating the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre was abruptly cancelled. And the university cited booking issues, but like with us, made no effort to rectify them. And then within this case, it was revealed through the Official Information Act that the event was cancelled following opposition from the Chinese consulate. So it's not conspiratorial or salacious in any way to claim that the Chinese government attempts to have influence of that kind, particularly within our tertiary education systems. It's demonstrable that they attempt to on occasions such as this. And so we need to be very aware of that. And while we held the event at Victoria, there were a number of academics who raised this, who said actually limitations on academic freedom and on free speech are not primarily coming from the progressive left. They are coming from external factors, international countries, for example, or managerial structural issues. And I think both of those are legitimate comments. We need to be aware and not fixate on simply one baddie, as it were, who is opposing free speech or academic freedom within our time. With regards to who else could emerge, I think that's a really important question. And what I would say is the Free Speech Union is made up of a very diverse membership. And we really appreciate genuinely the breadth that many of our supporters come from in terms of socioeconomic backgrounds, political perspectives, education levels, and all that. There is a component of those who are attracted to free speech at the moment, though, who I believe are in no way actually in favor of free speech. They're in favor of their speech. And at the moment, they find themselves in a time where their speech is being shut down. And so they suddenly love this idea of free speech because it's protecting their speech. But they're not actually invested in the concept of allowing anyone to have their say. And I think, again, this was illustrated last night. Michael Woodhouse, the List MP for Dunedin North, was a really good sport, to be honest, for the vast majority, a very polite event, but there was a small group of people that had come along who had obviously been at the Parliament protest and who really heckled him and who called him a liar, called him disgusting and booed down his responses and that kind of thing with regards to a particular question. And I would say that it appeared to me those individuals were not there for free speech. They were not invested in this idea that they should have a right to express themselves in the same way that Michael Woodhouse should have the right to express himself, though they may differ. They were there because they perceived that their speech was being shut down and we were an organization that we would defend their right to speech. And we would, but we would call them to respect that right for others as well. And so to your question, I think that one of the biggest threats is actually coming from groups at the moment, whether they are cultural conservatives, whether they are disenfranchised, perhaps economically, or the COVID-19 saga has produced certainly a very intense emotional response from a certain community as well. And I'm concerned that they are those that in the future could attempt to silence speech in the way that they feel has been done to them, this retributive way of thinking. And the effects of that could be ghastly in my mind.
Well, that's where I think, you know, the Free Speech Union over time will be able to counter demonstrate some of the accusations made against it, that it, you know, it represents the right, or that it's, you know, transphobic or whatever, just because you're defending the right of, you know, gender-critical feminists to speak, for example, of course, doesn't make you a transphobe. It doesn't make them transphobic either, the fact that they have gender-critical views, but that's another thing. The fact that you're defending the right to put a viewpoint forward doesn't mean that you agree with it. And, of course, the Free Speech Union doesn't take a particular position on anything except free speech, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, we are constantly working with people from across the spectrum. A lot of our work is not publicly known. And so, you know, there are the flashpoints of the Don Brashes or whoever it may be, but we are working with people from across that perspective. And exactly, there is a particular community that is seeking to silence speech at the moment. And so while the Free Speech Union does not take a position in any way on transgenderism or the many questions of public policy and culture that are associated with that, demonstrably, there is a portion of the transgender community that are ardently opposed to expression being allowed. You know, the hashtag no debate is what they operate under. So by no means are we transphobes, are we opposed to transgenderism, or what those individuals or what that perspective may represent. We are opposed to individuals trying to shut down debate. And it is one of the most prominent examples of censorship within the public society and public culture today that exists. And so that is why a portion of our work has been dedicated to that. But, you know, they may call us racist, they may call us transphobes. I don't think they were ever going to really like us one way. You know, they don't buy into free speech. And so that's really the problem. And they're just looking for the insult to throw at us, to label us with, to try and disregard us.
We've talked quite a lot about how the universities vary in terms of whether they've upheld the right of speakers to make their point of view known on campus, from, you know, Massey banning Don Brash to them actually welcoming him more recently, albeit with apparently a fairly intense security detail.
Yeah.
But is that the main thing that's made the difference between the high and low ranks, whether or not events are allowed to go ahead, or are there other factors that are as determining of the rankings?
Well, no, certainly the policies that are in place played a significant role as well. In addition, as we've discussed, to the ranking that the academics within the institution itself gave us. So how that correlated. But the policies are quite important as well. And so, for example, again, Victoria at the very top, they have a policy specifically saying that student protests will not result in students being trespassed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fantastic line in the center drawer where they're saying it's not about what you're protesting. It's not about which ideas you're vocalizing. Student protest, you know, and they have caveats around that, which I think are legitimate, not in certain offices, not in certain health and safety spaces, but on the university, students can protest whatever they want and they won't be trespassed. And I think that's a fantastic policy for them to have in place. And so it comes down to social media policies. What sort of constraints are staff at the university operating under? You know, we frequently represent members of ours who in their private capacity will post something, anything online that is then deemed questionable by their employer. Will these universities accept that that's in a private space at a private time? They really should be allowed to hold whatever views they want. Or does the university try and draw a line between them and their employees and go, you're representing us even in this private space at this private time? And so we can somehow control that. So we're drawing on that as well. And by no means am I going to claim it's a perfect science. You know, we're trying to illustrate the cause and the state of play here in New Zealand. If you want to pick at threads, this was not a comprehensive document. We're not trying to present that, but it's a benchmark for what we will build on in the future. And hopefully it does illustrate the state of play across our tertiary sector.
Yeah, and I think you've done something good here. That it's partly something that I think Michael and I are trying to do with our work at the Initiative in Education is just basically do things in New Zealand that are routinely done in other parts of the world or the English-speaking world in terms of statistics and getting information out there. And, you know, in the U.S., they have, I think, several rankings of free speech universities. One of them is FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, who've done a survey for a few years now. And in the U.K., I think there are a couple, but there was one that I know of by Spiked Online, everyone's favorite neo-Trotskyist come classical liberal website. They did a ranking of UK universities on free speech issues between 2015 and 2019. I'm not sure why they stopped. But obviously, you know, there's a perception in the rest of the English-speaking world that there's also this problem about free speech. And it also seems there, you know, a reasonable thing to do to collect information about how universities are doing, or, you know, collect impressions or you know, have a discussion in some ordered and systematic way about how universities are doing and put that out into the public sphere. So I think it makes perfect sense for us to be doing something similar.
Exactly. And I think this is a long-term project that will bear more fruit as that data is consistently updated.
Exactly.
Do you have a sense, Jonathan, of the extent to which the top leadership in a university is critical in whether the principles of academic freedom are upheld? I mean, one thing that's occurred to me is that maybe, you know, Auckland University of Technology, it's a relative latecomer as a university. The other universities have been around for a lot longer. Is it the lack of a tradition of academic life that is the problem, and therefore they don't have the policies, and therefore there's no basis to uphold academic freedom? Or do you think that, you know, now that Victoria is getting a new vice chancellor, it's all up for grabs and we'll have to see what his view of things is? So I'm asking, how important is the leadership in respect of academic freedom versus, say, the policy structure that the university has that may be more durable?
Members of my council may disagree with me on this. From my perspective, the individuals that are at play are pivotal and crucial in the way that academic freedom and free speech are upheld. And, you know, even for organizations like AUT, there are policies there that reference freedom of expression and free speech. And then the substance of those policies and the practice of those policies is then completely disregarded. So the policy structure is not one that I think actually bears much weight if the leadership is intent on abusing them. And I think we see that illustrated more generally in our society, where I think if you polled the average Kiwi and said, is free speech a good thing? They would go, absolutely. Because we're kind of, culturally, that's a rote response. But then you said, well, should someone be able to say hateful speech? And they'd say, no, you know, it's harmful, you know, all these things. And I think that they just completely misunderstand then what free speech is. Free speech in the public conception, and unfortunately, I think in the minds of many leaders of universities as well, is non-confrontational, non-provocative, peddling a common line. And that's where I go for, you don't need free speech for that. Just use free, just speech and it's fine because no one has a problem with it, right? Free speech is actually a radical, a perennially radical idea for provocative ideas and beliefs. And so I am concerned as we're going through this wave of a reintroduction of vice chancellors as we come through the tenures of several others and they will be replaced. My concern is that we will continue to see, and perhaps initially increasingly so, leaders that are openly opposed to the idea that speech and debate should be allowed really on any issue from any perspective.
So it's likely, in fact, that we owe Grant Gilford personally a debt of thanks for upholding principles at Victoria. And you know, maybe it's got something to do with his leadership and perhaps some others in his senior leadership team that Victoria has done so well. And we might reflect as well that he alone amongst vice chancellors, albeit after he recently retired as vice chancellor, has been on the Free Speech Union podcast.
That's right. And we have requested to sit down with other vice chancellors and to their credit, some have agreed to sit down with us, but most do not. And so the fact that Grant was willing to dialogue with us to disagree with us on some issues, but to have that conversation, I think very much is to his credit. And I hope that it illustrates that there's nothing to be afraid of in these conversations. One particular vice chancellor, Neil Quigley from the University of Waikato, says that as the Free Speech Union, we may be significant enough to present this data, and he said you may even be significant enough to have senior staff on board, but that doesn't mean I need to sit down with you while you're peddling these ideas. And I went back to him and I said, these aren't just our ideas. It's not like we've come up with a pet horse to flog here. Your academics are rating their freedoms quite low. Surely as a leader, as the vice chancellor in that position, it is your responsibility to consider their perspectives.
Yes. And so it's also important to note, I think, that a lot of these central ideas about academic freedom are enshrined in New Zealand law and also in the larger common law tradition.
And that's why I think the members bill that was put forward by Dr. James McDowell, the Training and Education Freedom of Expression bill that unfortunately didn't get past its first reading due to the Labour Party's opposition to its tenets, is so important. It's putting teeth behind the statutes that already exist. But I think that's a really good point you raised there. This isn't a matter of opinion or a matter of culture or philosophy. It's a matter of law. And while I don't want to over-egg it at this stage, because certainly it's not something that the ranking report delves into, I would venture that many of these institutions probably got their toes on that law, if not have crossed it already. So perhaps the time will come where we will have to see that in court to see these laws enforced and actually these universities held to account for the standards that exist within our statutes.
Yeah. Jonathan, I want to join both of you in praising Grant Gilford, actually, who was for a long time my VC, still my VC, actually, at Vic.
He's not, because he's resigned. But
I thought he was still sort of active. Oh, no, there's a different active VC.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, but anyway, I'll praise him anyway, even though he's recently departed from Vic, if not from this world. I think that he gets a lot of stick, and we took the mickey a little bit a few minutes ago saying, that he, referring to his effort to change the name of Victoria University of Wellington to the University of Wellington, which didn't go through. But, I mean, it's a tough job. You get a lot of flack. I have some sympathy for him, and I do think he deserves a lot of praise in this environment, in this atmosphere, just for going on the Free Speech Union podcast. I mean, it's kind of an extraordinary thing that it requires courage nowadays to do something
That's
like
right.
that. But I think that it does. So I want to say that. First up, I mean, having said that, I was actually, I was a little bit disturbed by some of the ideas that I heard from him in that podcast. I almost sort of don't blame him for them, just because I think the atmosphere for free speech is so bad. Mm. These kind of strange ways of thinking about free speech have come to sort of permeate the discourse about free speech. And I think a lot of ground has been ceded almost without people even noticing it. So I just wanted to pick up two of these issues. The first one is actually, it kind of seems like a relatively minor idea, and maybe it is, But it strikes me as quite a bad one, which has sort of established itself quite firmly, even for someone like Grant, who obviously will defend free speech to a certain extent. And this is the idea that academics should only really comment on things within their area of expertise.
Mm.
And it's very interesting. I can sort of see where it's coming from. I think that the case where most people would agree that you need to stay within your area of expertise to some extent is something like this. Like, imagine there's a doctor, and the doctor is saying, look, I'm a medical doctor. There's this new pill that we've produced, or this, you know, there's this new diet we've produced. I'm telling you as a medical doctor that this diet works, right? And so in those cases, you know, you might want to have certain regulations or customs around, you know, what you can claim. And if the person ends up not being a medical doctor, but being a doctor of classics, and you're sort of saying, you should take this diet because I'm a doctor and you're actually a doctor of classics, I think that, you know, most people would say that's a problem. But I don't think that most academic commentary is really anything like that. And I also, when this trope comes up, I think that people seem to forget how common it is for academics to sort of go out of there, to pass beyond their narrow area of expertise. It's just routine in the university, for example, that, you know, people who work on English poetry, for example, will comment on politics and socialism. And I don't have a problem with that at all. I mean, I just think it's fine. And I also think that, you know, even if you write an article for a website or a newspaper and you sign your name at the end and you say, like, I'm senior lecturer in classics or English or whatever it is, and you've talked about something else, something completely different, free speech, for example, most people are going to read that and they're not going to think, oh, he knows a lot about socialism or free speech because he's an English lecturer, because he's a classics lecturer. I just don't think many people reach that conclusion. So I think it's this very strange idea, and it's also one that has obvious potential to limit academics, because it opens people up to this comeback. Well, you can't speak about epidemiology because you're a microbiologist or something. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, you can have good ideas about subjects that are outside your area of expertise, or you can have bad ideas about subjects that are outside your area of expertise. And those things should just be publicly debated, I think, without trying to sort of shut people down in this a priori formalist way.
It might well give a tool to those who would suppress quite legitimate expressions of expertise, as you've just alluded, James, you know, making increasingly fine distinctions between one area and another and saying, well, you know, you might be an expert on ancient Athenian democracy, but what do you know about Sparta or whatever? You can't talk about Sparta. So I think what it misses is that actually, yes, academics do have very refined areas of expertise, but they also have broad intellectual knowledge and development and the ability to articulate ideas well and to think things through, because they've learned disciplines that involve the testing of ideas. And so that broader expertise has a role in all kinds of public discourse.
I might take a slightly finer perspective on it than perhaps what we're hearing here, in that I would say it does extend considerably beyond a doctor producing a pill for a diet or whatever it is. You know, we want our engineers to make sure they can build bridges, and our aviation experts to make sure our planes fly, and our IT specialists to make sure our apps work. So, but this is where I think there is a legitimate distinction between academic freedom and free speech, because in terms of academic freedom does not allow or facilitate an individual within an education or a research capacity to speak on any subject. And I would say that is appropriate, but they are still protected by free speech. You can be a mathematics professor and take a very strong view on IT or on vaccination or epidemiology or whatever it is. And as a human, not as a lecturer, not as an academic, but as a human, you have that right to those ideas.
What's the fundamental difference though? I mean, if I'm a professor of philosophy, say, and I'm speaking about farming techniques outside my area of expertise, and you could say, well, that's not, you're not exercising academic freedom there, you're exercising free speech. Why does it matter? I mean, if you're going to say there's this distinction between academic freedom and free speech, but free speech covers everything, then why have academic freedom at all? Because it's just all free speech.
From my perspective, I would say it's because it comes down to when we try and defend it. And so if someone wants to present to a select committee at Parliament, for example, in their capacity as a citizen and as a human, they should really be allowed to go there and present whatever ideas, whatever perspective they want. Free speech ensures that. And if someone tries to stop that, we would say, no, that's their free speech given right. However, if an academic wants to go before a select committee and argue a perspective beyond really what they're capable of commenting on, I would say that to then claim that the select committee disagrees with them because of their professional expertise, that, and they claim that right, academic freedom doesn't defend them in that space. And so that's why I do think it's an important distinction. I do think, and I don't want to draw too fine a point over it, but I do think there are differences at play there. And I think we, as free speech advocates, we can over-egg it a bit at times when academics get into these debates and then try and assert who is the most authoritative to comment in these spaces. I think questions of relevance and expertise and such are appropriate. But I think the point that you make, Michael, is very, very true when we make these increasingly finer distinctions between exactly what's being qualified in that space is. And I would illustrate that by the Mātauranga Māori debate that occurred about a year ago now. And Professor Garth Cooper, in particular, I think had a very hard time in that, obviously, along with Robert Knoller, especially with the Royal Society. But Professor Garth Cooper was a prominent medical educator and had worked specifically in what kaupapa Māori means within medical education for something like 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so then for these fruitless accusations to come out to say, well, actually, he doesn't have a right to say that because he works as a medical educator on kaupapa Māori and not on Mātauranga Māori. That seemed like a pretty fine distinction to try and make. It's a long bow to string. And notwithstanding that, it was free speech at that point, you know? And so that's where I think there are relevances there, but let's not try and place too much weight on that.
Well, yeah. There's another thing as well, which I'm not speaking directly to Mātauranga Māori here, because that's obviously, you know, like a well-established sort of body of lore and tradition and types of knowledge as well. But there's another thing which could go on here, which is that you can basically kind of form your own field and make certain claims about its boundaries. And then you could theoretically then use that to shut other people down if this norm of academics not speaking out of their field takes too much hold. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I could say, you know, well, look, I work on complementary medicine, and, you know, then someone in the faculty of medicine or biology could say, well, you know, these claims you've made about your new technique, they don't actually hold up because I've tested them. And I could say, okay, sure, you're a biologist, but you don't know about complementary medicine, right? And so, I, as I say, I think it's unhelpful. I think we sort of need to go back to this idea of, you know, just taking claims for what they are and debating the claims, you know, for what they actually have to say rather than who's saying them. And because really this idea of academics speaking from their area of expertise, it's one that places almost too high a value on expertise. I mean, I, not that I'm saying expertise is nothing, but I don't think it should be able to shut other people down.
Expertise should not be an authority in itself.
That's right.
What expertise denotes is that you have done a lot of study on the evidence over questions in a particular area, and therefore you probably have the right to be taken quite seriously when you say something, but you still should be open to challenge from anybody, regardless of their expertise or otherwise, on the basis of evidence. And it seems to me, you know, that select committee example you used, Jonathan, we should, you know, the person who just speaks from their views, maybe not very tested, maybe not very evidence-based, they should be certainly allowed to speak and given the courtesy of being heard, but perhaps that view will be given less weight than one that's backed by expertise and evidence.
That's right.
But either way, people have a right to be heard.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. No, of course.
All right. So just one more issue, and actually it's an issue you've already raised before. This is another one that came up in the interview with Grant Guilford, which is just really this notion of harm or provocation, because I think you guys were having this conversation about sort of, you were asking him, you know, have you actually seen academics who are trying deliberately to be harmful or provocative? And he was saying no, but I'm a little bit nervous about this whole idea of sort of being deliberately provocative or harmful, because it just seems to me that depending on your perspective, you might think that, you know, anyone is being deliberately harmful or provocative.
Of course.
And then there are all these questions of like, well, who gets to judge? I mean, because also, you know, in the university. Well,
and that was the point I was trying to get to.
Yeah, I think you did. That's why I said, I mean, maybe we just recap it, I suppose, in a sense, because you asked all the right questions and you've reiterated some of the same points today. But I mean, it does strike me that in the university as it currently is, with this huge political skew, I often see statements that strike me as quite provocative about men or white people or whatever. And again, because I'm kind of a grown-up and a liberal at heart, my inclination isn't to sort of ban these people or to try and get them in trouble.
Yeah, sure.
My inclination is just to sort of shrug my shoulders and say, okay, well, maybe I'll try and write an article that disagrees with this or something like that. So there's that point as well, which is that these claims can often be inconsistent. But yeah, but fundamentally, I'm just not sure provocativeness as a test is a good one for speech.
I would entirely agree. And I think you put your finger on what is one of the most dangerous aspects of the assault on free speech, which we're seeing across the Anglosphere in particular, or across the West. And if I can, I'll illustrate it again. We're in the work of controversial speech. That's what free speech defends. And so another slightly controversial example, where the Free Speech Union went in to defend Bethlehem College in Tauranga, where activists sought to have, it's a long saga, but activists were opposed to the statement of beliefs which defined a marriage as between a man and a woman. And one of the real tenets of their opposition was the harm that this would be causing to children at that school, at that college, and the ongoing impact that they would have. Patently, though, those that attend that school and endorse those values, and no one was required to endorse those values, the school was just stating that's what they believed. But any parent that sends their children to that school agreeing with those values would claim that to define marriage in another way would be harmful. And so this is where it is not to say harm is in the eye of the beholder. Some things are harmful and some things aren't, but it's not to say that you get to decide that for yourself. And really this pathologizing of ideas, pathologizing of speech, where we consider the fact that words could be corrosive and could embed a cancer within a child or within a community or whatever it is to perpetrate these ideas, it's very pernicious. And it, at its root, it undermines any sort of representative way of living in society. And fundamentally, we have a representative democracy. But even beyond the politics, again, just within a society, just within our culture, to have the right to participate, even if you hold different perspectives, to have the right to communicate with your children values that are close to your heart, even if the vast majority of society considers them repugnant. I wonder, again, I'll raise the same question, what do our would-be censors think will happen when they try and put the standards so high on what speech is allowed and try and restrict so specifically what ideas we're allowed to hear? And so this notion of harm, I think, really is at the root of the antagonism that is emerging against free speech. It's what we've seen as the key motivator on college campuses in the United States, on universities here, the quote-unquote harm that is done by exposing people to ideas that they don't agree with. And I think it is one of, that's why we are so dedicated to the work we're doing. I don't want to be sensational or hyperbolic, but it is really one of the critical foundations of the stable, peaceful societies that we know in the West. And you remove that, and very quickly, I think we will see that New Zealand is not above the many, many other communities throughout history that have been destined to violence because they could not tolerate one another.
Right.
More tolerance.
And that above all, of course, is what we want to avoid, you know. And it's interesting. I've just been reviewing with a colleague at Auckland, Brian Boyd, Karl Popper, you know, the great Austrian philosopher who came
to New Zealand. The Austrian philosopher. I'll let others decide whether he was great or not.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to put out there, I think he was great, but maybe you don't, but that's okay.
The paradox of tolerance is a very problematic.
No, but this is the thing. This is the thing, my friend, that Brian Boyd and I, I've just written up this big piece. I'll send it to you when it's out. We're putting the finishing touches on it now, but it seems that I think that the paradox of tolerance as put into this notorious cartoon, which has gone around the internet, I think that they've got that wrong. And really, if you read the totality of what Popper said about this subject, I think he would really have put the limits at violence. It's when people are making genuine sort of threats of death, or, you know, hoping that other people are going to die and things like that, or taking violent action of, or making immediate threats, immediate incredible threats of violent action. That's where the line is. And but he seems to have put that line there partly because he was a liberal in the broadest sense, and he wanted to allow lots of space for people to explore ideas and to pursue various life paths.
So
hopefully we can win you back around to Popper with that.
I look forward to that conversation.
I also think that he wasn't necessarily sure what the answer was, but what he was drawing attention to with the paradox of tolerance is that it kind of goes back to what we were saying at the outset, that liberal democracy, the open society, is an umbrella within which a very great array of viewpoints can be contested and debated and expressed. However, there is a point at which some ideas will threaten that very umbrella. And he's not even necessarily saying that those ideas shouldn't be allowed to be expressed, but that there is a threat there. My own view is that we have to trust to the values of open society to protect us from those voices, rather than trying to shut them down by force. Mm. But this is a question that we should discuss again. We should have you back and devote a full hour to this question, because it's a very deep one. But look,
absolutely,
you know, thank you for your work, Jonathan. Your passion and commitment to free speech comes across very clearly in the way you speak about it yourself and in the work you do. So thank you for the work of the Free Speech Union and for the work you're doing on academic freedom, and we'll watch closely as future reports come out.
And people can find the report on your website, can they, or where have you put it?
That is correct. And I mean, ideal, best of all, subscribe to the Free Speech Union newsletter. We're regularly releasing reports of this related to free speech at universities and many other communities around the country. So get those regular updates. But if not, you can find them on our website, www.fsu.nz.
Perfect. Thanks very much for joining us today.